MDN TV, the podcast. Be abreast with now. Never miss a thing with MDN TV, the podcast. We love to keep you in the present with diverse goodies from secular and non-secular subjects of global interest. Join us. Grab more from these series. Listen to our podcasts. The undeniable choice.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning, everybody. Yes, this is MDN Shows running with the times, only on MDN TV, the podcast, and I am Major Daughter. Welcome, welcome, welcome to all our listeners and viewers around the world. Meet us in the comments. We are live there. Engage, ask your questions, share this podcast, and if you have not subscribed yet, what are you waiting for? Because this is the hottest show on the planet, and we bring you the hottest guests on the planet, and today is no exception. I'm excited for everyone who keeps coming, and today is just one of those special days. I want you to take this moment, tell everyone that you feel well, find value in today's episode. Tell them to jump in, because today we're looking at one of the least talked about subjects, especially in the workplace, especially in our cycles and our groups and where we spend time, you know, having coffee or having our social meetings. We are looking at the five things every manager should know about leading an employee with cancer. Do you have some colleagues who are suffering from cancer? Do you have some colleagues who have been recently diagnosed with cancer? Then this is your show. Or do you know anyone who will find help and support from today's episode alone? Well, today's show is for them. It's for all of us. Sometimes we're thinking, how do we handle these things? How? What do we say? Many times I hear people say, we don't know what to say. When we hear that a friend has been diagnosed with cancer, we don't know what to say. We don't know what steps, support, all that and more. Right after this.
MDN TV, the podcast. Be abreast with now. Never miss a thing with MDN TV, the podcast. We love to keep you in the present with diverse goodies from secular and non-secular subjects of global interest. Join us. Grab more from these series. Listen to our podcasts. The undeniable choice.
The undeniable choice for today is indeed Kim Hamer. Look, thanks a gazillion times, Kim, for saying yes and for sharing yourself with the whole world. You watched your husband take his last breath, bowing to cancer. An HR leader you are. Whew, how did you do that? I'm thinking, you write about it and you talk about it and you are here. You've opened yourself up to the whole world to help. Not only that, you also penned down a book, 100 Acts of Love. Amazing work. But here is you, someone like me sitting here. I'm like, you are a bundle of inspiration.
Oh, well, thank you. I didn't start out to be a bundle of inspiration, but it just sort of happened.
You didn't start out as a bundle of inspiration, obviously. But how did you do it? What happened? Tell us a little bit about that. And then, because this is a story that everybody needs to know. We have so many widows right now and widowers.
Yeah. So, my husband and I were a regular two-parent household raising three young children. he wasn't feeling well, and we were treating his symptoms with, you know, cough syrup and fever medication. And when that stopped working, he started having trouble breathing. And so we finally went to the doctor. And it was funny because when he asked, when he told me he was going to go to this doctor, something in me said, I need to go with him. So I said, can I come with you? And he literally, as I was ending that sentence, he was saying, I want you to come with me. So we both knew something was wrong. We just didn't know what it was. And we get into the office and the doctor does an x-ray. And the reason my husband can't breathe is because he's got these little spots all over his lungs. The cancer at that point had already metastasized. And that means that it's already spread to different parts of his body. So he was already in stage four when we initially caught the cancer.
Wow.
And while he was sick and after, so he got better, he beat it. But while he was sick and after he beat it, something I noticed is a lot of people didn't know what to say or what to do. And yeah. Some people did. And those are the ones who sort of took action. But most of our friends, our family members, people we worked with just didn't have a clue. And they often said sometimes, you know, not helpful things, but sometimes they ended up saying hurtful things. And I just sort of started just taking notes sort of in my head. Then the cancer came back a little less than 2 years later. And 4 months after that, he died. And, you know, when people say, how did you get through it? When you ask me, Major, how I got through it, I honestly, you know, I often tell young widows, because I was a young widow at that time, I tell people, look, you just put one pinky toe in front of the other, because putting a foot in front of the other feels like too much. So it's just putting one pinky toe in front of the other. But what I noticed during that time was the support that we got, the things that people said and did were so important. And their importance actually increased the further down the line, further away from my husband's death I got, because I got to see how all those little things that they did were very helpful and supportive. And so that's sort of where the title of my book comes from, Acts of Love, because when people did things for them, I started thinking about them as acts of love. The little just kind of like, here's something to eat, an act of love. We're going to pick your kids up after school and take them to dinner, and then we'll drop them off. That's an act of love. We're going to drive your husband to the cancer treatment center. That's an act of love. So that's how it came about. Fast forward, I go back into the workforce, and my very first job in HR is working for a president whose wife has cancer and she dies. And I watched the whole organization not know what to do. And at this point, I think I was about 5 or 6 years out from my journey. And I had a clue about how to be helpful. So I started talking to my boss's boss of what to expect with a grieving employee. And I started talking to the other employees, you know, his team, about what they can expect of how to work with him. And that's when the idea started to percolate in my head that HR is equally as unequipped and managers are equally unequipped as everybody else and what to say or what to do. So several years after that, I wrote the book, and then I launched my consultancy where I guide managers and help them understand how to work with an employee with cancer and or employee grieving or dealing with, you know, death on the team. I think that most people kind of don't think about it, right? I mean, you know, when we talk about death, of course, people think, oh my gosh, what do I do? And we can feel uncomfortable. But when it comes to cancer, managers aren't thinking about how can they drive productivity? How can they drive employee engagement? How can they get their team to do the work that they need to do when one person is really suffering? Because that one person who's suffering, that affects the whole team. And I think managers just kind of don't put those two things together. And as a result, they lose an opportunity to really build engagement on their team, to be seen as compassionate, empathetic, but to also drive productivity. And I think that managers think that those two things don't go together when actually they do. So that's what I do now. That's sort of how my story morphed to this place that I am today.
Incredible story. Why are you doing what you're doing?
Because it's so important. You know, I'm not here because I'm super strong or because I managed to get through a really difficult time. I am here. The foundation that I stand on right now is made up of all those things that people did for us while my husband was sick and after he died. And those little things, because, you know, people think that they have to, like, you know, deliver food for 6 months. It's not about that. It's about doing these little things that you can do that are so powerful and helpful. And, you know, each thing that someone did made me feel secure. It was like I felt like I wasn't going to hit the ground really hard. I felt like I had this safety net underneath me. And it's really, I think managers, you know, when I take it into the workplace, you know, we're currently right now, at least in the US, we have a job market that is really tight. You know, we have, although we're having these layoffs, a lot of these people are getting rehired because of their skills, because we just don't have enough people. And we have this drive to just, you know, do really well, to drive revenue. And then we have all of these studies that have shown that the best way to drive revenue is two things. One, engage employees. And two, make sure you have diverse teams. And both of these things are really important. And managers, I think what happens is the CEOs and the senior executive team are like, okay, these are what we're going to do. But they don't offer managers the tools on actually how to do it. They just say, just do it. And so a lot of managers are really scrambling. They don't know how to drive employee engagement. And what I offer is these kind of five steps on how to really drive employee engagement when your team is in crisis. And, you know, it's not just about making money. It is about a manager feeling good about their ability to manage in a crisis. And it's about the team looking to the manager and feeling like their manager has their back and is concerned and cares for them, because that is what drives higher productivity. Yes. So that's why I do what I do. There's a moral piece to it. It's human. It's feels good for us to know that we're really helping another person. And there's also a business effect, a business side to it as well, because when you're helping somebody, you are actually supporting the team and the organization as a whole to be more productive and drive revenue.
Yes. And while we are helping, we should know what to say. What should I say to someone with cancer, as a friend, as a colleague, as a boss, as a leader?
What do I say? Sure. So I like to start with what not to say.
Okay.
And the number one thing never to say to anybody dealing with cancer, or really any kind of crisis, is if you need anything, let me know. Right? Oh, or yeah. Call me if you need anything, reach out. I'm happy to help, whatever phrase terminology is. And there are four reasons it's not helpful. The first reason it's not helpful is, y'all, it's you're not connecting. And I often like to share, like, do the opposite. So let's say something really good has happened to you, something fantastic. Maybe you had a baby, you just got married, you just bought a house, you got a new job, something, you know, something's happened really good in your family, something that makes you really happy. And you want to share this information with people. And you go out to lunch with six friends, and you know they all know that this thing has happened to you, and not a single person says anything to you. How do you feel?
Bad. Because yes. That's abnormal.
Yes, it's abnormal. Exactly. You feel bad. You feel ignored. You begin to wonder if you really want to be friends with these people. So that same feeling is what happens when somebody is dealing with cancer. If you don't acknowledge it, you're feeling bad, right? People, the number one thing we all want is we want to feel connected. And so that statement, if you need anything, let me know, actually skips over that feeling of connection. So I'll share with you what to say instead at the end of this. But so that's the first thing. The second reason it's not helpful is, Major, what is anything? What is anything?
Yeah.
Right? Hmm. I had a toddler when my husband was first diagnosed. Did anything mean that you were going to go to preschool and pick up my vomiting toddler in your just cleaned car? Or did anything mean that you'd be happy to drop off a bottle of wine or a gallon of milk?
Wow.
Right? Anything is too big a word, and it's too hard for someone who's already in crisis to wrap their head around. The third reason it's not helpful is because now you've left it up to the person to try to take apart their day and figure out one thing that they may need help with. And from my own personal experience and my experience of talking to many people who have survived cancer and many widows and widowers is that they don't know what they need, especially when they're in the middle of crisis. Like I remember not knowing that I needed pasta until the water was boiling and I had gone to the cabinet to find pasta and there was no pasta. Right? I didn't know I needed gas in my car until I turned the car on. And sometimes it almost sputtered and didn't start because my head just wasn't engaged. So you're now putting the pressure on the person who's in crisis to figure out what they need. And then the last reason it's not helpful, and I don't know about the culture there in South Africa, but in the US and a lot of many other cultures, it's really hard to ask for help. We aren't really good at saying, hi, you know, I need help. I need you to do this for me. Right. And so you, when you say that statement, that's what you've done. So you're asking a person who is really, really, really vulnerable already, feeling like their life has just been turned upside down. There's all these weird things happening with their body or with their person's body, right? They don't know. I mean, you know, when we hear cancer, we know that if they don't get it treated, they will die. So that's a very scary, scary proposition. And so when we say those things, we're not helping them at all, although it feels like we're being helpful. So what I often tell people, on a really quick side, another thing that managers say is in panic when an employee comes to them and says they have cancer, they say, take all the time you need, which is not a helpful phrase to say either. Mm. So what I tell people to say instead is you want to first acknowledge what's happening. And this means sometimes saying a phrase, which leaves most of us feeling uncomfortable. And that is, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm so sorry this is happening to you. But you say it in a way where you're acknowledging where they are, right? Yes. You're acknowledging this is a crappy thing. So another thing you can say is, I don't know what to say. I'm in such shock, right? So you're, again, you're acknowledging the information, yeah, the horrible information, yeah, that this person has just given you. You want to take the time to do that. And you want to do it sincerely. You don't want to do it, you know, because we can all tell in tone, I'm so sorry this is happening. We can tell that you don't really mean it when you use that tone. So you want to take a moment to kind of zone in on what the person just told you. And y'all, it's uncomfortable. Like, I don't know where we think that we should be comfortable when we get this information. It is uncomfortable. And your response is really important and requires you to have the courage to deal with your own discomfort. Many of the times, the things that people say that are mean or cruel or just not helpful come from our own place of discomfort in talking to the person, right? Or managing it. Mm. So in order to say the right thing, you have to have the courage to be uncomfortable because it's not fun. It doesn't feel good. That phrase we're uttering is not going to fix anything. But what you are doing is you're taking the moment to connect with the person. And that's really important. The second piece of what you want to say is you want to be specific on the kind of help you're willing to offer. Now, people say, I don't know what I can do. You do. We all have helping superpowers. There are things that we like to do that we're really good at or that bring us pleasure. And so that's what you want to start to think about. So in the home, what you want to think about is, are you a good cook? So offering to bring a meal is really important. Instead of asking, what kind of meal, say, do you want chicken or lasagna? That's sort of something that we do in the United States. People love to bring these big plates of lasagna because you can, you know, heat it up and refreeze it and heat it up again. So that's just an example. You don't want to give them, tell me what you like, because that's too much, but say, hey, I'm happy to bring a meal to you on Thursday. Do you want this one or this one? So that's something you can do very specifically. I am not a cook. I'm not going to offer to bring you food. In fact, I'm not even going to offer to pick up food for you. But what I'm really good at is I'm really good at grocery shopping. So if there's that one thing that you need that you can't find, call me up. I will find it for you. So that's what I offer sometimes. I often say, you know, if you need something from the grocery store that's hard to find, let me know. So it's really, really, really specific. At work, here's a great example. Let's say you're really good at Excel spreadsheets And this person does a report. The person who now has been diagnosed with cancer does a report, and they include Excel spreadsheets. And you know that they sometimes come to you for help on how to make this pivot chart, or how to make a pie chart, or how best to represent the numbers that they have. You can offer that. You can say, hey, I'm your data. I'm your spreadsheet person. If you need help cleaning up a spreadsheet, or if you need help figuring out what graph you want to put on your report, let me know. I'm happy to do it for you. So we all have skills at work and at home, things that we're good at. I had people offer to clean my kitchen. I went and offered to clean someone's bathroom because I just like clean bathrooms. It makes me happy. So I scrub their bathroom. Maybe you're good with kids, so you can help with kids. Maybe you're really good at putting together agendas, so you can help with that at work. Maybe you're good at running meetings, so you can help that person with running the meetings. So there are all things that we are good at that are very, very helpful. I think sometimes people think that we need to like come up with these grandiose ways that we're going to help. You know, some of the most meaningful help I got was simple little things that people did for me once. So that's what you want to do instead. You want to offer a statement that really recognizes what that person is going through. And then when you offer help, you want to be specific on the type of help you want to offer. And you want to offer more than once, because that person who's in crisis right now is not dealing with a full deck of cards, and they're gonna forget. So make sure that you remind them that you're here to do that thing. And what you're doing when you're doing that is you are providing them with this kind of this foundation, a safety foundation. You're letting them know what you're willing to do. That's huge, because everyone else is telling them, if they need anything, let me know. So you're letting them know what you're willing to do. You're reminding them that you're willing to do it, so that just in case they've forgotten. And now they know. Oftentimes what happens is they don't always come to you for that thing, but they might come to you for something else that they really need, because you have made yourself a safe person. You have made yourself a person they can trust, that when they think about that one thing, when they do come up with that one thing that feels really random, that they can go to you to ask you to do it. And maybe you can do it and maybe you can't do it, but you can also find someone who might be able to do it if you can't do it yourself. So that's sort of the big thing about what to say. It's really important that you acknowledge it and that you offer specific support.
Boy, we are so guilty.
I am too.
That let me know if you need anything actually means don't let me know. I don't know.
Exactly.
Deep down we know we don't want to be involved. So it's a nice phrase. It's glamorous. It's nice to say I'm a phone call away. Whereas I know I don't know. That is why I'm not putting any word. I'm not taking any responsibility for anything. I mean, who's comfortable with asking for help?
Yeah.
Whew.
Major, you are so on it. It's really, I mean, it's a cop-out phrase. But people, even though people really mean it, when they say it, it's a cop-out phrase. Because, yes, again, of everything we just talked about. And the thing is, I said this phrase all the time until my husband got cancer. And even when he first had cancer, people kept saying it to us. And I was feeling very loved. I was like, oh my gosh, all these people are offering help. And then when I really needed something, I realized how useless it was. Because I didn't know who to call. I was afraid to call someone and ask them. I thought what I needed was really stupid, right? So there's all this shame stuff that I have to work through in order just to make a simple phone call. So yeah, it's a really, so now, even now, it starts to roll off my tongue and I have to stop myself. It's so ingrained in us to say it that even now I have to kind of, I catch myself occasionally.
Help has a name. So many people offered help that you could not describe. You don't know what they offered. And we know, yes, that help is a name. I'll take your children to school for the next 6 months if that will help. It's different from,
yes,
I'm a phone call away. What am I, who am,
yes,
I, where am I going to start when I'm making that phone call? To
right,
who?
Because right.
I don't know what is their strength. Where is their ability?
Right. Exactly. And Major, I want to get back to what you just said, where you said, you know, take your kids to school for the next 6 months. The offers don't have to be that big. Uh-huh. It can literally be, I will take your kids to school for the remainder of the week, and then I will help set up something so your kids can have rides to school. Like, you don't have to take on, like, one of our friends actually did take this on. He set up rides for our kids so that our children were picked up every day. They went to a different school where there wasn't a school bus. He made sure that our kids had rides every day to school. That was something he did. And occasionally he would do it. But, you know, I think the thing is, people often think the other side is, people think, oh my gosh, I now need to help. I need to do this whole thing for the next 6 months. You don't. I will tell you, one of the most meaningful things that someone did for us, it was for me. It was after my husband died. And my neighbor one day wandered up to the house, knocked on the door and said, when was the last time the oil was changed in your car? And I couldn't tell him. I couldn't tell him, you know, we had the car that gave you a little signal if it needed to be changed. I couldn't tell him. I couldn't even tell him if the signal was on. And he said, okay, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm home all day tomorrow. Why don't you leave the keys in the mailbox? Text me when you do. I'll come pick up the car and I'll take care of that for you. Now, just that offer itself was helpful because he said, leave the keys in the mailbox, which meant that I didn't have to face him. And as a person who receives help, it's often hard because we feel like somehow we have to pay them back or that we're not good enough, right? We feel like we just can't say thank you enough. So he gave me a break from that emotion, from those emotions. So he does it. He picks the car up. He takes it. You know, 1 minute I look out my driveway, the car's not there. And the next minute I look at my driveway and it's back. And I go, I've got the kids at home with me at this point. And I go to get in the car and I walk outside. I walk to the car and I start to cry. And I get in the car and I turn the car and I start to sob. Because not only had he changed the oil in the car, he had had the car washed inside and out. Wow. And he filled it with gas. It was one of the most amazing gifts to me in so many different ways, because I was a functioning adult, or so I thought. I was grieving. I cannot tell you how many times I almost ran out of gas because I simply forgot to look at the gauge. And it even happened while my husband had cancer. There's so many other things that are going on in your life that doing simple tasks like filling your car with gas become like take Herculean effort. So he had taken that pressure off of me. I didn't even realize that I needed gas. And had I realized that I needed gas, I would have felt so stupid calling someone and saying, hey, can you come get my car and fill it with gas and put it back in my driveway when I was home? Like, I would have felt so dumb. So there's no way I would have called anyone to do that because I felt like I should have been able to do it. Like I was judging myself, but I'm a grieving widow or I'm a, you know, a caregiver. And this pressure of trying to, you know, helping my husband stay alive is huge. So I wouldn't have called anybody. And then he took it upon himself just to clean the car, right? He noticed that the car needed to be cleaned and he cleaned it. And so this gift was so powerful. Major, how many times do you think he did this for me? Just take a guess.
Once, twice.
Yeah. Once.
Yeah.
And it is it is one of the things when I speak, it is one of the stories I share all the time. Because it's so powerful. So people think you don't have to come and do it for me, do it for the person all the time. Right? It's the small little acts that really make a difference. Whatever it is you can do, if it's you dropping a bottle of wine off at the door or flowers or bringing a meal once, that's okay. If it's bringing them a hot cup of coffee at the beginning of their day when they just returned, you know they have chemo maybe Mondays and Tuesdays, and you know they come into the office on Wednesdays, and you bring it once, or you bring a ginger candy because nausea is the thing that happens sometimes when you get chemo, right? Just once. So you don't have to take these. I think sometimes we think we need to get so involved in the person's life. No, you just need to do something because you're something piled on with something else. Someone else's something piled on with someone else's something piled on someone else's something makes this beautiful net and makes them feel like they're connected and cared for. And that's a beautiful gift that you're giving to anybody who's struggling.
Once he did it, twice it was imprinted in your heart and you tell it everywhere. And that's many, many times. I am very touched by that because I know that acts of love are not expensive acts. They are hearty acts. And that's what many people run away from.
Yes.
That hearty act.
Yes.
Now, work and the workplace is about production, is about productiveness, is about effectiveness, it's about results, it's about driving profits and everything. But how can a leader balance the employees' need for support and the team's
needs? That is a great question. Yeah, that is a really good question. And here's how. A lot of times managers feel that they can't have open conversations with the employee because they have cancer. So they feel guilty about talking to the employee about their work because their employee is dealing with this big, huge thing on the outside. And another place that courage is needed is the manager needs to sit down with that employee and have those discussions. And what I mean, the discussions are things like, tell me what your treatment plan is. How often will you need to be gone from work? Let's talk about what it is that you have to do in the next 2 months. And let's figure out what's high priority and what you can work on and what's low priority, what we can let go. Who on the team do you think can help during this time? Right? I think sometimes as managers, we think we know our team. I mean, some managers really do know their teams, but we forget that our teammates know each other's strengths sometimes better than their managers do. Yes. So you want to ask your employee, who do you think on the team would be a good help in getting these projects done while you're unable to do it? The biggest mistake managers make is one, ignoring it, right? Just kind of thinking that we'll just make it work. And two, thinking that they're helping by removing projects from the employee. Because when you remove projects from the employee without discussion, you are basically telling the employee, you're not going to be able to do this. You're not going to be good at it. And we need to get these things done. And getting them done is more important than how you feel. And you want to make sure that getting things done is as important as the employee feels. So it's really important that I say that a lot. It's really important because it is. Yes. It's really important that the manager have these open and honest conversations with the employee. It's going to do a couple things. One, the employee is going to feel supported. And look, y'all, not everybody with cancer is going to lose their hair, is going to get weak. Like we have these stereotypes in our heads about what it means to have cancer. And then we act based on those stereotypes. And a lot of times those stereotypes are completely incorrect. So one of the stereotypes is someone with cancer isn't going to be able to work. Well, 65% of the people who get cancer want to work or have to work. So the idea that someone can take off and not work is not accurate. So making sure that you understand those and you have those honest conversations, your employee is going to work harder for you, even during the short sprint times that they have with you. Your team, because your employee is going to talk to your team. Your team is going to know that you're supporting that employee and you're working hard to get the work done and being empathetic. So they're going to actually trust you more. And trust is a key motivator for what we call discretionary output. So having trust in your manager allows employees to feel like, hey, you know what? I want to go the extra yard, the extra time, the extra effort to help do my job well, because my manager needs it. And because my manager rewards me and knows that I can do it. Right. And the third thing you're doing is you actually are building this cohesiveness because the team knows that you're taking care of your employee. So those are really those things allow you to actually drive higher revenue. So, you know, we see this in studies, Harvard Business Review, Sloan, MIT Sloan, you know, we see this in studies over and over and over and over and over again. You build trust with honest conversation, being who you are. So showing, you know, that you feel bad for this employee. When you build that trust, your team trusts you and will work harder for you and your engagement will go up. So this isn't theory. This is actually proof. We've seen it happen in workplaces over and over again. But it takes courage. It's uncomfortable to have a conversation with an employee about their cancer diagnosis. And in the US, there are some rules around what we can and cannot say. But if you do it, if you get past your fear and past your discomfort, you're going to end up with a team that is more cohesive and will drive productivity for you and revenue for you in a way that you didn't think possible.
Wow. Now, what happens when someone dies in the workplace? How can we better manage?
Death in the workplace? That's a really tough one. I recommend a couple of things. One, that the manager, I just did a blog post on this, that you make sure you talk to your team immediately, that you give the news to your team before the team members give the news to each other, right? It's really important that that news comes from you if you're in a situation where that can happen.
Yes.
You want to express your own feelings, right? You don't want to go in there being like, well, yesterday, John had a heart attack and we're all very sad and funeral arrangements haven't been made yet. So I'll let you know. You don't want to go in there like that. You want to be shocked. And oftentimes when there is a sudden death or even when there's death from cancer or long-term illness, there's sadness. So you want to talk about where you're coming from. You're saying, I'm feeling really sad. Y'all, I don't even know what to tell you. I don't even know what to say. Then you want to give your team some foundation, right? So this whole point of this process is to give a foundation to your team. So that foundation is I'm going to reach out to the family or what, you know, I will find out funeral arrangements and let you all know. I'm sure there are ways that we can help the team. So to help this person's family. So I'll let you know. You want to let the team know, hey, everyone, I really prefer that you not reach out to the wife, the child, the mother, whatever, the husband right now. I want to make sure that we cohesively don't add additional work to them. So I will find out from the family, or I know, Joe, you have a really good relationship with them. You and I can talk afterwards. So you want them to know that there's a plan in place, how you're going to support them. The other thing that I warn managers about is grief doesn't just go away at work. It's not like people get to work and then they shut the grief off and then they work and then they go away and grief comes back on. So it's really important that you give your team time to grieve. And that means that it's going to take several months for your team to really work through their grief, if not longer, work for their intense grief, really. And so there's things that managers can do and things that they can set up. The last thing I always recommend is that you actually have a memorial service in the office. So separate from the one that the family puts on, because sometimes team members, one, don't feel comfortable going to those services. And two, the services are really for the family, right? They are for the family who are grieving. You need something for your own team to let them grieve. This is so deeply, deeply important. And it's something that most managers are really uncomfortable with because we're uncomfortable with feelings at work. But I've seen it been very, very, very effective. People feel a sense of relief when they can come together. It's a ritual. We all have, you know, there's not a single group of people in the world who don't have a death ritual. Yes. So it's a death ritual and we all need them. And having one personally for the person you cared about at work is really important and will help your team. So that's what I want to say there. There's lots more to do and to talk about on that front. But yeah, death at work is really an important thing that a lot of companies just kind of gloss right over. And you have to train your team on what to say to a person who just lost their partner, right? So when they go back to work, you don't want people saying really mean and stupid things, but like most people, they don't know what to say. So you have to take the time to train your team. That's another really important thing. So yeah, there's a lot here. Major, you and I could be on this talk for another hour.
Yes. You're right, because it sounds so easy. It sounds like it's a walkover, but it's not. People really get stuck out there, not knowing what to say.
I'm
thinking.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead, please.
No, I didn't hear you. It cut off. So please repeat it, what you just said.
I'm saying people get really stuck not knowing what to say. You know, it's a daunting experience. I mean, some people have never lost colleagues before.
Yeah.
And training is a place where we need to start conversations like this one. And do you know what? It's amazing about the conversation we are having right now is that this applies everywhere.
It does. It really, really does. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of amazing. And it blew me away when I first started talking about it, because it applies if you're in a relationship. Yes. And you know, if you're dating and the person's mother dies, you need to know what to say.
Exactly.
You know,
some will just look at you.
Exactly. If you're a student, you know, my kids had to deal with kids who said really mean and hurtful things. Wow. You know, and we're talking about 7-year-olds. You can train a 7-year-old what to say and how to connect. Yes. You know, high schoolers, they're feeling awkward and weird and they don't know what to say or what to do. So there's, you know, this, it applies everywhere.
Absolutely. So this talk is not just about work. It's not just about cancer. Churches will need it. Outside the workplace, we still need it in our cycles, our clubs.
Yes.
The show comes to an end, but the conversation doesn't have to. How can people find out more about you and what you do? Are you open to assist privately? I don't know. What else are you doing? Where? Because we live in a virtual world now. Are you talking to some weirdos out there? I mean, with so many weirdos and widowers out there, people don't know what to do. They think, in fact, that grief is contagious. It's not. But I don't think it ever ends.
Yes.
It's just in stages. It just gets to different levels. How could you ever stop grieving?
Yes. I think, you know, there's a really interesting post by a widow friend of mine. She's One Fit Widow on Instagram. And she just did a post about how, like, this, you know, she's, my husband died almost 14 years ago. I'm not sad when I talk about him anymore. Yeah. I'm not crying when I talk about him anymore, but he's in my life every day. Yes. Right. There are little things that I think about, or that, you know, that he used to do on the outside that I have internalized in me. So he's become part of me. You know, so, but grief, you're right. Grief doesn't go away, but it morphs and it changes and it becomes this very different thing. So let's get back to, really quick. So the best way to reach out to me is, first of all, I know I mentioned one thing never to say, but I actually have a list of 5 things never to say. So, and what to say instead. I want everyone who's interested to join my email list. You go to 100actsoflove.com. That's 100actsoflove.com/what not to say. So what not to say. And there you will find, you'll get this free download of 5 things never to say, why not to say them, because I think that's really important that people understand it, and what to say instead. So you have alternatives. The other thing is, yes, I do work privately. I work with companies. A lot of companies will reach out to me, especially when they have a death on their team. They're not sure what to do, what to say, how to even go about it. So they reach out to me there. I work with managers who are really interested in working with employees who are dealing with cancer and depression, which is a new big, you know, phenomenon. And then I also, I do once a month, I do these webinars where I teach managers or people 5 skills that they can use to really show up in helpful ways with their person. So with their employee, with their team, with their manager who may be sick, with, you know, with their friends. And so once you're on my email list, I will let you know. Those happen the first Wednesday of every single month. So those are all the different ways that I can be reached. You can also reach me on LinkedIn at 100actsoflove.com. And by the way, the 100 is the number, not the spelling of it. So those are all the different places you can reach me. And I'm always, always, always happy to talk. Absolutely.
That website again is 100xoflove. Links in the description. .com, of course. Links are in the description. Please do check that out. If anything is missing, ask for it. You want to grab that book as well. Kim, you are such a bundle of inspiration. I honor what you do. I respect what you do. I pray we have more people who'll do what you do. You help us say the things we couldn't say openly by ourselves on our own. Today you have helped us to do that in many ways.
Thank you, Major. I really appreciate that.
Your last
really, really appreciate that. Everyone matters. I just want people to know, you know, we often think that we're not important to our friends or our coworkers, but we're very important. So you matter, and I want to provide you with the tools to show up.
Yes. Whew. Beautiful. That is it. Kim Hamer. Check it out. The website is, again, 100xoflove.com. I got it right from me. And Kim, to you is well done.
MDN Talk Radio. The mic swings to you. At MDN Talk Radio, the conversation is upbeat with life-enhancing chats moderated by personalities that matter. Exclusive conversations to keep our radio community interactive is with you now. Log on from the comfort of your couch or take us along in your palm as you go. Hear us. The undeniable choice.